Wisconsin's lakes are real treasures, but there are many threats to their health, and that means threats to our health as well. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Larry Mueller today. Steve Carpenter is the director of the UW Center for Limnology. He was part of a worldwide collaboration to look at the impact of climate change on natural areas of global significance, and he's also looking at what that means for Wisconsin. And Steve, good to have you back on the program.
Thanks a lot, Judith. I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, this is really important work that you've been involved with, and really kind of amazing in its scope. You were part of this global study and report looking at the effect of climate change on specifically three UNESCO World Heritage sites that are natural areas. Where did the impetus for this study come from?
We were interested in what could be done locally or regionally to deal with climate change, and most of the members of the committee are ecologists, so we were looking at places that are ecologically interesting, and the World Heritage Sites naturally attracted us.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times people think of UNESCO World Heritage Sites as man-made structures, amazing architecture, temples, things like that, but these are all natural areas.
Well, that's right. And actually, globally, I believe more than two-thirds of them are natural areas, places like beautiful parks, mm-hmm. or very unusual living things like the Great Barrier Reef.
Mm-hmm. And so the Great Barrier Reef was actually one of those three. We definitely want to go back to the impacts of climate change on Wisconsin's lakes, but I do think it's important to touch on those sites that were identified and talk about why they're of such critical importance and what needs to happen. So the Great Barrier Reef in Australia is one.
Mm-hmm. Right. The Great Barrier Reef is a very important fishery and obviously a hugely important recreational site. It's an enormous reef that stretches up the entire eastern coast of Australia. It's a spectacularly beautiful and remarkably diverse place, but it is in danger from nutrient runoff, similar to what we have in Wisconsin, and overfishing, not so much of a problem for us. There's also a very big coal industry in Australia, and the sediments from that coal industry are also a threat to the reef. On top of that, there's the long-term threat of climate change and ocean acidification, which could eventually be very harmful to the reef. So our group looked at steps that could be taken today to begin to essentially armor the reef or build the resilience of the reef to potential climate changes. And we came up with a number of recommendations, including managing nutrient runoff, managing the runoff from the coal mines and coal processing facilities, and limiting the fishing.
And reefs are actually living ecosystems, right? There's a whole lot going on there.
A coral is a living animal, and the reef is a complex of these living animals, and then all the other plants and animals, the fishes and so on, that that live around it.
So another area, not surprisingly, that was looked at was the Amazon rainforest.
Well, that's right. And that's obviously a very critical area, both culturally and biologically. Another extremely diverse, beautiful place, and the lungs of the planet. It carbon fixation and oxygen release from the Amazon are really critical to the dynamics of the planet as a whole. And once again, we looked at what could be done for managing natural areas in the Amazon that could build resilience to climate change. The idea being that local people often feel that they have limited leverage on climate change. It's really going to take all 7.3 billion of us to get together to solve that problem. And people are interested to know what they can do locally or regionally to essentially hedge or buy time while the global problem sorts itself out.
Mm-hmm. So You referred to the Amazon rainforest as the lungs of the planet, and I've certainly heard that before. What are the biggest threats to those lungs? I'm guessing deforestation is probably
right.
A big issue.
Deforestation is the big immediate threat, and so setting up some criteria for managing the forest sustainably so that it stays there and isn't simply removed is a principal concern.
So we talked about the Great Barrier Reef with Australia, the Amazon primarily being in Brazil. So very different. How would I say it? I mean, Australia is definitely a first world country. Brazil is still developing in some ways. How would you gauge the different commitment of the governments, which have to kind of be in there, and also the resources that they have available?
Mm-hmm. Well, both governments are trying to deal with the problems, but of course there are always ups and downs depending on how national politics go. Brazil certainly needs to hold the line, and there have been some improvements in recent years, and those need to be maintained. Australia right now has a government that is really not dealing with climate change. They just released a major report on the Barrier Reef on Friday. Interestingly, the day after our paper was released, it was just by chance, and that report completely ignores climate change. And it does address nutrients and fishing a bit. Actually, there is a fishing plan in place for the Barrier Reef that's been fairly effective and works fairly well. But it completely neglects the role of the coal industry in the damage to the Great Barrier Reef. And the politics in Australia have been pretty rough and tumble over that report, from what I read in the media.
The third area that was covered in this report was Spain's Doñana wetlands,
right?
Which I have to say, not quite as well known, I'm guessing, as the other two.
No, it's not as well known in the United States, but it's a major flyover stop for migratory birds that move between Africa and Europe. So it's incredibly important to the summer bird fauna of Europe that Europeans enjoy, just as we enjoy the birds that fly into Wisconsin from Central America. And the Doñana is a region that where I think a lot of Wisconsinites would feel right at home. It resembles the Horicon Marsh region where many of us have been, and other areas, the bottomlands along the Wisconsin River, for example, that run almost the length of the state. If you've ever been there, you would feel at home in the Doñana wetlands, and they face those wetlands face many of the same problems that our freshwaters in Wisconsin face. Mm-hmm. There is too much nutrient discharge. They have some sewage discharges as well, and hydrologic problems due to water diversion for development. So not only would it look familiar to you, the problems are some of the same ones that we face in our state. And with ongoing climate change, the Doñana wetlands will begin to dry out potentially. And so dealing with the water budget and then also dealing with water quality to maintain adequate quality for the plants that support the birds is a big issue there.
How big an area is that?
All I can say is it's really big. I can't quote.
That's your scientific opinion.
My scientific opinion. It's larger than Horicon Marsh.
Okay. That's great. We are talking with Steve Carpenter. He's the director of the UW Center for Limnology. He's the Stephen Alfred Forbes Professor of Zoology at UW-Madison. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. We're talking about climate change, the impact on important natural areas around the world, and bringing that back to Wisconsin, what we can learn from this kind of global collaboration to improve or protect the quality of our lakes. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you worry about the health of our lakes in Wisconsin? Maybe you wonder what you can do to help to keep our lakes healthy for generations to come. Steve is happy to give you suggestions, as he said that it's going to take pretty much everybody in the world addressing this. So we might as well find out what we can do. That's 1-800-642-1234. Steve, we just said you're the director of the Center for Limnology. What is limnology?
Limnology is the study of inland waters, lakes and streams, also wetlands and groundwaters. We usually take credit for those too.
So fresh water.
It's fresh. Well, not entirely. Inland waters are not all fresh.
Okay.
The Great Salt Lake, for example, an inland water that's salty.
Okay, there we go. So inland lakes. And one of the things I was wondering with the Great Barrier Reef is, you know, we talk a lot about with climate change, increases in temperature. I think we often think about it as air temperature, but it's actually water temperature, too. How much change does it take for there to be an impact in an ocean?
The oceans are changing, and I'm not an oceanographer, but according to the media that I've read and articles that I've seen, the oceans are taking up a lot of the heat from global warming right now. So mm-hmm. that is having some effect.
So you talked about the fact that the coal industry in Australia is a threat to the Great Barrier Reef. That seems much more immediate. It sounds like the long term could be that part of the ocean is also warming up, which I think coral is extremely sensitive.
Well, that's right. So in the short term, it's the runoff from the coal industry that's a concern. But in the long term, warming and ocean acidification are a concern for the Great Barrier Reef. Mm-hmm. As we build up carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which drives the warming, we also build up the amount of carbon dioxide in the ocean and in lakes, and carbon dioxide is a mild acid. Mm-hmm. So it's making the oceans and lakes slightly more acidic.
Steve Carpenter is the director of the UW Center for Limnology. After a look at the news, we are going to talk more about what was learned from this report that looked at three UNESCO World Heritage sites, the Amazon Rainforest, the Great Barrier Reef, and Spain's Doñana Wetlands. We're going to bring it home in the report. They say many of the world's ecosystems are under a double whammy of threats, global climate change and local pressures. And we're going to find out what those local pressures are to our Wisconsin lakes and what we can all do to help stem those effects. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. I hope you'll stay tuned right here to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Mendota, Pepin, Winnebago, Mirror, Kangaroo, Camelot. These are just a few of the thousands of lakes that we are lucky to enjoy in Wisconsin. But like critical ecosystems around the globe, they are facing a serious challenge from climate change. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking today about the health of our lakes and how, as a state, we can plan for their healthy futures. Steve Carpenter is the director of the UW Center for Limnology. He's the Stephen Alfred Forbes Professor of Zoology at UW-Madison. And Steve, thanks again for spending time with us.
Thanks so much, Judith.
So we will get to the phones in just a moment, but just to kind of frame the discussion, we've been talking about this really amazing global collaborative to look at the Amazon rainforest, the Great Barrier Reef, and Spain's Doñana wetlands and the challenges that they are facing currently and that they will face because of climate change. Here you are, you were part of this group, and you are the head of the Center for Limnology here at UW. What were you hoping to, and what did you take out of that experience that you can bring back to your work here in Wisconsin?
Well, in fact, I learned that people around the world are facing many of the same problems that that we are facing. And at the Center for Limnology, we've been doing a lot of thinking about how we could make lakes more resilient to climate change. For example, we know that phosphorus pollution is a big problem for many Wisconsin lakes. And we also know that lakes become more sensitive to phosphorus as they get warmer. So it takes less phosphorus to cause an algae bloom in a warmer lake. And so if we can take steps to reduce the amount of phosphorus, then we can counter that effect of climate warming on the lakes. So we have been doing a lot of work on methods for reducing the flow of phosphorus from agriculture and from urban areas into lakes, and trying to communicate that information to the public and lake managers so they can take steps.
And what happens when there's a big algae bloom in a lake? What are the implications of that?
Well, in the summer, the species we get are often toxin-forming species.
Like and the blue-green algae.
Right, which it, the technical name for those is cyanobacteria, and because they really are bacteria, even though they look like algae because they're green. Mm-hmm. Certain strains of the cyanobacteria release these very deadly liver toxins or brain toxins that make the water unsafe for swimming or drinking. Many listeners will remember what happened in Toledo last summer when the water supply was closed for a time due to a massive algae bloom that they couldn't purify. They didn't have the technical capacity in their water purification plant to deal with it. So, they had to bring in bottled water. They quickly ran out of bottled water. I've got I have a 16 fluid ounce container of bottled water right here. I was just looking at a website before I came over, and this 16 ounce bottle got up to $14.99.
$15?
$15, during the
algae. Which a lot of people just couldn't.
Oh,
do.
No. Yeah. Right.
Wow. Well, we have some callers on the line, so let's go to the phones. And Raleigh in Oak Creek is up first. Hi, Raleigh.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. And sure. I'm an avid lake swimmer. Just as a side question, I'm wondering why I haven't gotten sick yet from all these bacteria that you're talking about. But my original question was, what kind of invasive and non-invasive species can we expect in the future as climate changes, particularly in Lake Michigan?
That's a great question. And as far as the not getting sick from the algae blooms, has Raleigh just gotten lucky, Steve?
I would say you've gotten lucky. Also, some people get sick and they don't realize it. They may not connect the fact that they went swimming a couple of days ago with a stomach ache that they get later. Mm. So perhaps you were not acutely sick, but in any case, I'm very glad that you've not apparently been ill. Predicting which species will become really obnoxious when they invade is very difficult. It is fairly easy to predict which species are more likely to be able to invade as the lakes get warmer. And there's a project at the Center for Limnology called the Smart Prevention Project that works on lake vulnerability to different invasive species. But it's really difficult to predict whether the species is going to be obnoxious or not. Some of the very harmful invaders that we have right now are rainbow smelt, which eliminates walleye production, rusty crayfish, which eliminates habitat for bass and bluegill, and so damages that kind of fishery, and Eurasian water milfoil, which I would guess is the most hated aquatic plant by Wisconsin boaters. Mm.
And also, what about zebra mussels?
Zebra mussels are a big deal in the Great Lakes. Zebra and quagga mussels are responsible for clearing the algae out of the water, and that takes the food away from the open water food web. And there are a number of fishes fishes we really like in the open water food web. For example, all the salmonids that that support the big salmonid fishery. So zebra and quagga mussels have been very harmful in Lake Michigan. They are in a few inland lakes where they are also causing problems.
Thanks for that call, Raleigh. Let's go back to the phones on Beth in Washburn. Hi, Beth.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
We are facing the potential CAFO coming up to the town of Eileen right outside of Ashland.
And just to make sure people know, CAFO is Concentrated Agriculture Feeding
Animal feeding operation.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's a whole lot of. Is that one pigs or cows?
This one's going to be a hog breeding operation.
Okay.
And we are just pulling out every stop to try to prevent this thing from coming in, because we've already seen what's happened in other parts of the state, and we don't want that happening to Shawamigan Bay, which, you know, that's all of our tourism industry there. So I'm learning more about a CAFO than I ever thought in my entire life. we're finding out that this thing will produce more manure than the whole Bayfield Peninsula, the whole populated area of the Bayfield Peninsula. And all of these towns have had to put in sewer systems to keep that from going into the lake. And this, they're not required to do that. I mean, this is, you know, they have their plans, but they say that you can count on there being runoff of manure into these wetlands. It's not to prevent it. It's just to deal with it when it happens, which is really not an acceptable way to look at life here.
Sure. Let's let Steve respond to that. So is you're talking about preventing runoff, preventing phosphorus. How big a problem are these large scale animal facilities?
Probably, I would guess about half of the phosphorus that's going into Wisconsin lakes, roughly, is derived from manure. And CAFOs are a very big source of manure. And manure has a lot of phosphorus in it, so it's the major driver of toxic algae blooms in Wisconsin waters. It also has a lot of organic matter in it, which decomposes and removes oxygen from the water, so that can lead to fish kills. So there is no doubt that a large manure runoff source is liable to cause problems. The only effective way to treat it that I have ever seen is to essentially treat it like human sewage and process it to remove the phosphorus. And there are a variety of experimental processes that can be used to do that. Of course, they add to a cost of running the animal feeding operation, and so usually some sort of regulation is needed to make that happen. This is a global problem, by the way. As human population grows and as people get richer, they want more meat in their diet, and the most efficient way to produce it is in these very large operations, and they exist in every rich country and many of the developing countries, and we are seeing globally an increase in toxic algae blooms as a result of the spread of these operations. And to my knowledge, no country has yet arrived at a policy solution that is effective. I think many of the technical pieces to solve the problem exist. Many of the engineering capacities are known, but coming up with a policy that actually implements these and treats the manure like the sewage it is has so far not occurred. I think one thing worth noting is we went through the same thing with human sewage a century ago, and nobody really worried about the sewage we were, the human mm-hmm. waste we were dumping into fresh waters. The Madison lakes received direct inputs of human sewage until 1971, which will be within the lifetime of many listeners.
Wow.
So it took us a long time to realize that dumping human excrement into lakes is a bad idea. We'll come to the same recognition eventually mm-hmm. with animal waste, I expect. I don't know how long that'll take.
So how did the lakes rebound after there were more regulations?
That's a really interesting question, because it turns out they didn't. And this led to great shock and dismay when the sewage treatment plant was built and the lakes didn't get better. And it took probably 6 or 8 years before the scientists, and I was actually among those scientists, figured out that, hey, we've just replaced human waste with animal waste. And so all the time we were focused on human waste and slapping the high fives for solving the human waste problem, the animal waste problem was building.
Okay.
And by the time we had the sewage treatment plants online, the animal waste had more than replaced the human waste.
Interesting. So what does that mean for resilience? Do you think that if there was a concerted effort to address animal waste and phosphorus runoff in general, could the lakes rebound?
I believe they could, yes. For one of the best pieces of evidence for that is in the drought years, our water quality gets better. And what happens in drought years? There's no runoff, or there's a lot less runoff.
Oh, interesting. There are other problems, but...
Well, you're right. Drought, yeah, we don't want to solve our lake problem by having droughts, because eventually the lakes will all dry up and we won't have any lakes.
Right.
So drought is not the solution, but drought does show that if we can eliminate the runoff for a time, the lakes get better fairly quickly.
Mm. So that's a hopeful point. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that call, Beth. Let's go to Tom in Janesville next. Hi, Tom.
Well, hello.
Hi.
A comment. When I began as a DNR angler instructor over 30 years ago, the DNR started putting out a list of streams and rivers and lakes in the state from which they recommended you not eat the fish or even waterfowl that lived on those. And it was a one-page sheet. And now the annual report is a multi-page booklet. And so the mercury, PCB, pharmaceutical pollution of the waters, even though a lot of it is non-source, it has accelerated rapidly, and I assume will continue to accelerate. And I would assume this is a problem not only here, but around the world.
Yeah, and you're cutting out a little, Tom. So let's have Steve respond to that. Where do those contaminants come from, Steve?
Well, there are varied sources. The mercury actually comes from burning coal upwind of Wisconsin, and elemental mercury from the coal burning is deposited in the precipitation on our lands, lakes, and wetlands. And some of that mercury is converted into a toxic form by bacteria. Not all of it, some of it. And that toxic form builds up in the aquatic life and gets into the fish and creates a threat for humans who consume the fish. Most of the PCBs and related compounds were inadvertent byproducts of paper bleaching. And many of those sources have been controlled. PCBs are now banned for manufacture in the United States, although there are still a lot of PCBs that are stored that are that were manufactured and have not been destroyed yet. But they're at least they're not in the environment; they're in barrels somewhere. So the PCBs are a byproduct of paper. Bleaching. Let's see, what else did you... Oh, you mentioned pharmaceuticals. That's an interesting one and very recently discovered. And it turns out that certain pharmaceutical chemicals are very stable in the body. They pass into human waste, and our sewage treatment plants are not engineered to destroy them. And so they get into lakes and rivers, and it's been shown, for example, that they, in streams, for example, they can decrease the production of food required for trout. So they actually do have an impact on the aquatic life. One reason that you're seeing an increase in the number of pages in the DNR guideline is that we are discovering more kinds of pollutants as our chemistry methods get better. So some of it is new discoveries like the pharmaceuticals.
I'm wondering, too, with the pharmaceuticals, I mean, we've been talking about how cattle or, well, animal waste is as big or bigger a problem than human waste. There are a lot of pharmaceuticals that are used with animal production
Absolutely. One of the biggest problems is antibiotic use because, you know, microbes are they evolve extremely rapidly, and antibiotics are a very strong selection pressure on the bacteria. And so you get rapid evolution of antibiotic resistance bacteria. And when those bacteria are pathogens, then doctors lose a tool for killing them. And there's been a lot in the media about methicillin resistance in bacteria in hospitals, for example, which is a very, very severe problem. And, you know, so if you think about the course of human history, we've had these miracle drugs, the antibiotics, for maybe 60 years or so. I think the usage really became common right about World War II or after World War II. And we may be approaching a time where none of them work on the critical bacteria. So it's I think that is really one of the most severe issues that that faces us today.
So we've talked a lot about the problems and the challenges. What needs to happen, in your opinion, Steve, on a policy level to address the issues now and the issues that we know are coming down the pike?
Well, I think we need to get serious about phosphorus, and we need to severely constrain the phosphorus discharge into the surface waters of Wisconsin. And I think that the engineering solutions are out there. It's a matter of using them. On invasive species, it turns out that the best thing you can do is inform the public. And if you let them know this is a bad animal or plant, and here's how you can make sure you aren't the person who spreads it. Mm-hmm. It turns out the public is really good at stopping the spread, and there have been a number of cases where that's worked out. So we just need vigilance and good information out to the public on invasive species.
So, as you said, the public really does care about these issues. What else can individuals do? Because it's really easy to feel helpless and hopeless. What can individuals do to help protect our lakes?
Well, I you can be careful about your own phosphorus discharge. For example, if you have a pet, pick up the waste. Don't wash your car in the street. Think about the fertilizer that you put on your lawn and try to keep that to a minimum. We have a phosphorus ban for lawn fertilizer in Wisconsin, so that helps. So those are all things that people can do, and also in engage in the discussion about what we're going to do about agricultural phosphorus discharge. It's a big industry in Wisconsin, and the discharge is the major source of problems problems for our lakes, and recreation based on the lakes is also a big industry in Wisconsin.
Yes.
So we'd like to keep both of those things around, and we need to figure out the policies and the technologies to do it.
If someone wants to find out about the health of a lake in their area or a lake that they love, that they, you know, make a point to go to every summer or something like that, where can they find information about specific bodies of water?
Well, often there's information posted at the visitor center associated with the body of water itself. Many bodies of water are surveyed regularly by the DNR, and you can find information on the DNR website. And there is a project underway right now, a collaboration between DNR and the Center for Limnology, to use satellite imagery to get information about lake clarity and even algae concentrations in lakes. That isn't quite online yet, but it's coming soon.
Well, keep us posted on that. Steve Carpenter, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, Judith.
Steve is the director of the UW Center for Limnology. He is the Stephen Alfred Forbes Professor of Zoology at UW-Madison. Really interesting information, and we do have a link on the Facebook page to the report and a press release about that report that looked at UNESCO World Heritage Sites. Well, coming up tomorrow, we'll get some great consumer protection information about scams that are making the rounds in Wisconsin. I hope you'll join us tomorrow. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller.